This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 143 was recorded on November 29th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. Macro Intelligence 2 founder Julian Brigden will join me as this week's feature interview guest. Longtime listeners will recall that Julian has an excellent track record anticipating moves in Treasury yields, so I'm particularly keen to get his take on the 10-year yield, which has surprised some observers by falling back down to 3% this week. We'll also discuss equity markets and much more. Julian is also one of our featured speakers at the Macro Voices live event in Vancouver on January 19th, so I'll ask him to describe what he plans to speak about there as well. Be sure to stay tuned for extended equity market coverage in our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick and I will return to the equity market chart book and consider the ramifications of the market perceiving Fed Chair Jay Powell's comments as being indicative of a dovish pivot in Fed policy.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500, since the Thanksgiving, kind of dipped from 2750 down to towards 2630 and then back to 2750. It was a little bit of a roller coaster ride in the last week. What's your take on the S&P here?
Well, the big factor that is really propelling things upward this week is Jay Powell's comments on Wednesday. So many people all through the industry are just telling you what it means. Let me read what he actually said word for word. Rates are still low by historical standards, and they remain just below the broad range of estimates of the level that would be neutral for the economy. Patrick, the only thing that changed here is the wording has changed from a long way below to just below. And everybody is reading meaning into that as if the entire world has changed completely and we have a whole new Fed policy ahead of us. That's a possibility. Certainly, they do use these small changes in language to signal changes in policy. But I think the market is reading way too much into it. It's possible that we're seeing a complete U-turn in policy by the Fed, but frankly, I doubt it. And I think that the market has probably overreacted to this. It remains to be seen what the Fed will say in coming days and weeks to clarify whether or not they really meant to signal a policy U-turn, which is the way a lot of people are perceiving this. So the question becomes, is there really a dovish pivot, and will the market continue to perceive that there has been a reversal of policy? I think that's what took us the really big move up on the S&P on Wednesday, was really due to the market's perception of what they think Jay Powell meant. And, you know, if the market continues to perceive that, and if there really is a U-turn in Fed policy, and the Fed is becoming much more dovish and no longer intends to continue hiking rates into 2019, well, that is a major change of policy. It could have bullish implications for the stock market and bearish implications for the dollar. But again, I think the market is reading too much into it. In any event, Patrick, I know that you guys have been killing it at Big Picture Trading. You told your members last week when we were still 100 points lower, hey guys, cover your shorts because there's a perfect setup here for a squeeze that could take the market 100 S&P points higher. Needless to say, that's exactly what happened. So I'm very curious to hear what you guys are doing next. Let's come back to that in the post-game segment when we can get into your chart book.
Sounds good. So let's move on, though, to the dollar index, which has once again approached the highs from earlier in November, up in the 97.50 level on the upside. And then on the Powell comments, kind of backed off a little bit off of that level. A lot of people are saying that that's a reversal or some sort of a double top on the dollar. But yet the trend is pretty intact on the upside. Do you remain bullish on the dollar here?
Patrick, you're the first person who has described this the way I see it. So many people are saying the dollar crashed on Powell's comments. It's crashing. Look, if it's crashing, it's crashed all the way back down to levels not seen since drum roll please, 2 days previous. We gave back 2 days worth of gains in the dollar, and we're already seeing a bounce off of that number. The pattern of higher lows and higher highs is still intact. So I don't think there's any reason to say that the dollar is crashing or that a major reversal is upon us. Now, certainly, if the market continues to perceive, and if there is confirmation from the Fed that they really did mean to signal a U-turn in policy, that would have definitely bearish implications for the dollar going forward. My leaning is still dollar bullish. I think what we've seen is a reaction in the dollar index to an overreaction by the market to what Jay Powell said. I think it's very likely that we can fade that and that we'll be moving back to new highs and maybe breaking above 97.5 in coming weeks. Again, if the Fed were to confirm that they really did mean to signal a U-turn in policy, that's another story. But right now, my inclination is to think the market is reading too much into Powell's comments.
Now, Eric, I've been waiting all week to talk to you about crude oil. Last week, you made that call that we were trading somewhere around the 53 handle and nobody could believe it has fallen that low. But you actually predicted it might actually fall further. And it did, rather dramatically. So what's next here? I mean, we basically are testing the 50 handle here on the downside. There was a little bit of talk that that reversed it off of this level, and we're now trading around 51.53. What's your take here? Are we going to see a short-term low on oil here?
Well, I think there's a lot of moving parts here. Let me describe what I think is going on. First of all, we did get down and actually tested a 49 handle overnight, and it was comments out of Russia this morning. But I think the market is really misinterpreting some of the data, because the comment out of Russia this morning was they said that as they're looking at production cuts, they really don't think that a large cut is needed. They're leaning towards a much smaller cut than had been announced previously. So a smaller cut would tend to be bearish. But just the fact that there's any discussion of any cut seemed to jerk the market higher. So the market seems like it's looking for an excuse to move higher. We saw the same thing after inventory. Crude oil building 3.6 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma. Remember, we had been a little bit flat on Cushing the last couple of weeks. Back to the pattern of big builds. 1.2 million barrel build in Cushing, Oklahoma. Gasoline drawing down, but only 764,000 barrels, less than a million. Meanwhile, distillates, big build, 2.6 million barrel build on distillates. That's a pretty darn bearish inventory report. And of course, the knee-jerk reaction on the price was to the downside. It only lasted a few minutes. And before you knew it, the market was rallying again. So it seems like so many people feel like, wow, we've just so oversold. It feels like an exhaustion point where the market is looking for any excuse to move higher. But at the same time, when we did move higher, sure enough, once again, we got to that 50-day moving average on Wednesday and ended up reversing right there and dramatically moving to the downside. Now, on Thursday, as we're speaking, we did take out finally the 5-day moving average. That's the nearest one, the very first target to the upside. We took it out, but it looks like as we're speaking mid-afternoon, we're taping the show a little bit early this week, on Thursday, we're retracing back down toward that 5-day. So it remains to be seen. Actually, the pit close looks like it's going to be just about a little bit above the 5-day moving average on Thursday. So it's the first time we've closed above the 5-day, and I can't count how many sessions on my chart here. So the really big bearish momentum has started to peter out. It's not quite as strong as it was, but I do think that more downside is still possible here. And the reason is, what I think is going on is we kind of had a perfect storm where U.S. production is up, Saudi and Russia increased their production on expectations of Iran sanctions. The Iran sanctions were less stringently imposed than planned or initially discussed. That meant that less Iranian supply came offline. All of a sudden, and one of the factors that really contributed to the sell-off was news coming out of Saudi Arabia that they hit an all-time record high production number of 11.2 million barrels Saudi Arabian production. Meanwhile, the U.S. is still holding steady at 11.7 million barrels, also an all-time high record.
So, Eric, it really feels like this is all building up into this G20 and OPEC meeting next week. All eyes are out there. It looks like the markets are at these really important crossroads. What do you think is going to happen? How does this all play out here as we get into these meetings?
Well, you're exactly right. And I think that's the reason that the downside momentum has petered off and we're kind of holding here right at that $50 psychological round number level, bouncing off of it today. But, it looks like we may already be retracing back down towards it. So what's going on here? I think that the market has figured out that President Trump is really playing Mohammed bin Salman. And it's very clear that Trump has enough dirt that if they wanted to push it on the global stage, they could make a big fuss over this and they could force Saudi Arabia to sacrifice Prince Mohammed bin Salman and make him kind of the fall guy for this whole Khashoggi murder, which is pretty darn clear that they got caught red-handed in this. What President Trump has been doing is coming to Saudi Arabia's defense at every opportunity that he has publicly, and in the very next sentence say, keep it coming down, keep it coming down. So it's a message to Mohammed bin Salman. I am saving you from losing the throne by bailing you out here. You better play ball with me. And I think the market is trying to figure out, okay, that's working, because when we saw, and I think the big confirmation of that was the 11.2 million barrel print coming out of Saudi Arabia, which is, yeah, Trump's been blowing smoke on Twitter for a while now, but would it really make any difference? Then they saw that all-time record 11.2 million barrels of production and said, yeah, it's working. They are pedaling as fast as they possibly can. They are responding this time to President Trump's pressure. How long are they going to keep responding? And all eyes have turned to the G20, which is this weekend, and then the OPEC meeting, which is next week, is where this all plays out. And frankly, Patrick, if you asked me, okay, what's my prediction when we speak next week, or let's say after the OPEC meeting next week, what's my prediction for the WTI price? There is no number between $40 and $60 that would surprise me. Another $10 of downside is entirely possible if we were to discover that because of this pressure that President Trump is asserting, that Saudi Arabia backs away and says, no, we don't really want to agree to a production cut. We're not going to do anything or take any action at this meeting. You could easily see 10 bucks to the downside. Likewise, you could come out of G20 this weekend with some indication that, okay, we're not going to take any more of this. We're going to cut aggressively. President Trump, you've had as much play as you're going to get out of that political pressure. We're not going to succumb to it anymore. And you could see $60 by the end of next week very easily. I tend to think, Patrick, that the downside scenarios have more potential. And the reason I say that is just that Saudi Arabia has been very slow. You would expect them to have already been making stronger, more affirmative statements by now. We're going to cut aggressively in order to support the price. We're down $25 from where we were. It's time to take immediate action. And they're instead couching their statements and not being definitive and not making committal statements. It makes me feel like maybe Mohammed bin Salman is scared to death that if he doesn't play ball with President Trump, he could literally lose the throne, lose the kingdom that he is heir apparent to as a result of that. And, you know, maybe it's worth it to him to just play Trump's game for a few more months. And, you know, how long does this play out? That really is the big question. So I could see it going radically in either direction from here. And I think G20 and OPEC over the next week are going to be where it all plays out.
Eric, how would you trade this? What are you doing here? How are you going to play this oil move here?
Well, I suppose you could consider straddles, and maybe I should be, but what I've been doing is accumulating long-dated calls, no directional trades. I don't dare to. As I say, I think it could go either direction, and it could go really hard. The insiders will know before we do what's really happening, and there'll be the tape is going to tell you long before the news does what's coming next. I think that we're already at a price that is well below where we should be on a fundamental analysis level. So I'm starting to accumulate long-dated calls on crude oil. And I've got a big stack of resting limit orders to accumulate more of them at lower prices if we continue to see a sell-off into next week. As I say, I think it could go big either direction. Right now, I'm just accumulating, but only through options. I don't want to touch the outright on futures right here.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because we've been obviously for a month or more toying with this idea that gold could short squeeze to the upside and some big break of the 1240 level was going to spur on a big move. Instead, we've been pinned in a sideways coiling formation, and gold neither wants to go down nor up, just trading sideways. Is this just going to continue like gold in purgatory, or is this winding up for a big move?
I think maybe we are winding up for a big move, but it's been very news-driven. You know, it looked like, as we saw on Tuesday, Patrick, there was a really big sell-off in gold, and I thought, boy, okay, maybe we're starting to see that move on dollar strength to the upside. We're starting to see the move to the downside that I was predicting in gold, and I thought as the dollar continued to move up, maybe we would go back and get back below 1,200 and maybe test that 1,175, 1,180 level where we'd bottomed before, and see what happened. Then, of course, what happened was on Wednesday, Jay Powell's comments were perceived as this policy U-turn, and that was the reason that we saw the price go shooting up so dramatically on Wednesday. Will it last? So far, the follow-through hasn't really been there. I think we're waiting to see whether or not the market continues to believe in this reversal. You know, what we ought to look at is what are euro-dollar futures showing us? So maybe you can add that to your post-game chart book, and we can come back to it in the post-game segment. But euro-dollar futures, and particularly the spread between them, is a good gauge of where the market is pricing expectations of further Fed rate hikes. And I think that is going to very definitely play into the gold market. So let's come back to that in the post-game segment.
Sure. Well, on that note, let's actually touch on the 10-year Treasury yields, which have continued to decline. I mean, we were at 3.25 just earlier this month, and we find ourselves testing the 3 handle right here on the downside. What's your thinking here?
Well, Patrick, Julian Brigden is the man on this subject as far as I'm concerned, so I don't want to steal his thunder. I'm going to leave a lot of the Treasury yield discussion for the feature interview. But briefly, my view here is, okay, it's very, very significant that we have this move back down to 3%, well below 305. Remember that we had Keith McCullough on the program. He predicted, hey, if we see 305 taken out to the downside, that would be confirmation of a prediction that he made when the 10-year yield was all the way up at 3.25, saying he thought it had topped and he thought we were headed back down to the 250, 260 level. We have now the confirmation signal that Keith was waiting for. That really has caused me to feel like, yeah, we've got, at least in the short term, some kind of move lower in yields. And I think it was a, I don't know if you want to call it a false breakout or a head fake or what you want to call it, but the people who thought as soon as you broke 310, there's no turning back, it's the end of the world. You know, the market loves to embarrass as many people as possible. Everybody who was singing that tune, and there's a lot of them, were humiliated by the market when we saw this reversal. The fact that it's moved as far down as it has says to me that it's got some momentum and there's plenty of room to continue to go lower in yields. Now, the big question, Patrick, is does that invalidate the secular bear market call that we've talked to Julian so much about in the past? I don't want to get into that. Let's save that for the feature interview so that Julian can give us his thoughts.
Well, thanks for the market update, Eric. Now, this week's featured interview guest is MI2 Partners, Julian Brigden. Eric's interview with Julian is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is MI2 founder Julian Brigden. Julian has been one of our most prescient guests. A lot of his calls on the fixed income markets in particular have been incredibly accurate, and it's so timely to get him back on the program as everyone is wondering, okay, what's going on with 10-year Treasury yields? Are we really headed much higher from here, or are we seeing what actually might be the beginning of a major retracement downward in yields? Julian put a fantastic fantastic chart book together. Registered users will find the download link in your research roundup email. If you're not registered yet, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says looking for the download next to Julian's picture. Julian, before I get into specific questions, let's start with the really big picture of what drives the fixed income markets. What is the big picture driver of yields that you look at, and how does that play in to your overall thesis that you've described to us in past interviews, and what are you seeing now in this market?
We have been very adamant, and we got lucky at calling the lows back in July of 2016, as yields were sort of around 135, 136, in saying that we thought the low was in Treasury yields. And I mean the low. And one of the reasons for that, Eric, is that I think people frequently misinterpret the bigger picture. The bigger picture is really set to a large extent by demographics. And I think a lot of people draw inferences to Japan and say, look, you know, 10-year Treasury yields have to go to where 10-year JGB yields. And to me, that's wrong for a couple of reasons. Firstly, Japan is a little unusual. It eats what it kills. So it does fund its own deficit. The United States is a little different. It actually relies on overseas funding of deficits. And so when you look at that, you have to consider a much broader demographic pattern, because broadly speaking, the way that demographics works in asset prices is quite simple. You're in your 20s, you start to work, and into your 30s, you live it up. Okay. And we've seen that with the baby boomers in the 60s and 70s, you know, drugs, sex, and rock and roll, and don't care about the consequences. Unfortunately, during that process, you end up getting your girlfriend pregnant and you have a child. And so you go from spending, okay, where you're not physically saving. And that means the money isn't going into treasuries and it isn't going into the equity market, okay? And then you start to save as you build that family. And definitionally, this is when bond yields start to fall. Now, when you look at the broad pattern for the United States and the people who buy US debt, we're hitting an inflection point. We hit that inflection point in about 2015, 2016. And that is, these people now are starting to retire. And definitionally, when you retire, you become a dis-saver. Now, maybe we can do what the Japanese have done, which is why, remarkably, the Japanese working population hasn't really peaked yet, is we can keep working people till they die, right? The average age of a Japanese farmer is almost in their 70s. You know, they literally attach little exoskeletons on these poor gut buggers so they can reach up to the plum tree to pull the plum down. But the point is, if we don't, as people retire, they are going to become dis-savers. Okay, and they're going to start to consume again. Now they spend on far less sexy things than they did in their 20s and 30s, right? Adult depends, you know, and healthcare, it's not nearly as sexy as sports cars and living it up, but nonetheless, they dissave. And as they dissave, bond yields should rise. So big picture, I don't believe there's any structural change in the story whatsoever. But this is relatively glacial stuff. And the reality of the situation is that we've been saying this to our institutional clients. We said the process of higher yields and higher rates was never going to be linear. In fact, we borrowed a phrase, two steps forward, one step back. And we've been pushing this short in the fixed income market as a way, because we've been saying, look, we're just running this economy way too hot. Okay. You know, we had financial conditions basically at 50-year lows domestically here in the United States. And we need to raise those financial conditions. And the way we've been believing it would happen predominantly was via a combination of higher treasury yields and to some extent a stronger dollar. But the thing that had worried us, Eric, is that when we look at the world, we think that we've actually recreated some of the excesses of prior cycles. And so as rates rise, that creates quite a lot of damage. And so you can't just have this straight rip linear up move in rates. They move up, they do some damage, they come back. And the two areas that have particularly worried us had been housing and stocks. And as those have started to correct, we can see that the fixed income trade has become a lot more difficult. So if we move on to slide 4 in the slide deck, just to illustrate some of our concerns about these excesses that have been created in the system, the first one we want to highlight is in the US equity market. So if you look at this slide here, what it shows is the relative performance of the US equity market, US MSCI, versus the rest of the world ex the US. And the first thing I would note is we have never seen relative performance of this an extreme level, right? This is beyond anything we've seen since the early 70s. And the second thing is, it's highly unusual to see any US outperformance in an environment where the Fed has been tightening. The only time in history, and I've highlighted it in purple here, where we've seen the US equity market outperform at all was in that very brief period in the 90s. So what we have now is really, really incredible. Really incredible outperformance of US equities. And I would say it's almost, the danger is this has become a reflexive bubble. So in other words, we've had this situation where, courtesy of the Trump stimulus and a very, very lax, gradually raising Fed, okay, whose financial conditions were made ridiculously easy despite the fact that they've been hiking Fed funds. And this has created this growth adrenaline rush, which has allowed, along with dollar strength, this outperformance of the US equity market as dollar strength has helped suck in money from the rest of the world. So it's almost arguable that it's a reflexive bubble. And when you look at the next slide, slide 5, there's no question where that risk is concentrated. It is definitively concentrated in the NASDAQ. Most global equity markets, you can see here, have sort of come back to where they were in March of 2009. Okay, if you look at slide 5, you'll see here that the excesses are definitively concentrated in the US and most acutely in the NASDAQ. Because if you look at most markets have made about 100% returns since March of 2009. Okay, the S&P and the Dow have made about 300, but the NASDAQ's done 500. Right, a fivefold outperformance versus the rest of the world. This is definitively excessive. Now, as we've just seen today, and we're talking, I'm sure as Eric will remind everyone, just after Powell's recent speech, it's not difficult to engender a bounce in the equity market. And maybe we'll get more of a one this weekend if we manage to pull off some sort of ceasefire with the Chinese over trade. But it's going to be a lot more difficult in the next area of the economy, and that's on slide 6.
Let me just ask you a question on slide 5 before you move on, Julian, which is, as we look at this outperformance of the NASDAQ, it seems to me you could make an argument, hey, something's extraordinary there, or you could say, well, wait a minute, tech stocks tend to be more volatile anyway. And so I wonder if we were to look at other periods of performance going back, you know, in the 90s, I would guess the NASDAQ, when things were all going up, dramatically outperformed. To what extent is it just a more volatile index versus to what extent is it a unique phenomenon to this period?
I think it definitively is a more volatile index, but there are some, you know, you would think something like the KOSPI, right, which is Korea, it's highly export orientated, you know, should also do well. I haven't put it in here, Eric, but there's actually a chart. If you take the S&P growth index against the S&P value index, right, within the S&P, two, you know, identically calculated indexes, what you'll find is the ratio of those two indexes actually to the tick topped where we were in March of 2000 back in September. So within the growth value space, within the US markets, which is really what the NASDAQ is all about, we push that ratio right back to the dot-com bubble high. And I'm pretty clear, and I'll show you in a chart in a second, that I think within that space, and if you follow me on Twitter, you'll have seen this, right? There are definitive, what I would call classic bubbles in a whole slew of names in the US equity market. So I do think this is very excessive. And the risk with an excessive market like this is, when you create excesses in the system, is as you try and normalize policy, things can become quite unstable, right? And I think, unfortunately, that's where we're sort of finding ourselves. Now, as I just said, I think it's quite easy to reverse or at least boost a highly volatile equity market. The biggest excess that I think we've reflated, actually, you'll see on slide six, and that's in housing. And this one really worries me. Now, the first thing I will say is when you look at new median house prices, you have to be a little careful. I'm not saying that we've pushed them so far below 06, 07 highs. What we've done, though, is we've changed the mix of housing that we build. So there are no more two-bedroom affordable apartments that have been built in the last few years. Everything is luxury two-bedroom with all the bells and whistles. So the underlying median cost is definitionally higher. But the point is even if you take existing homes, okay, we have pushed prices back up above 06, 07, or at least 2006, 07 highs. That's atrocious. So not only have we arguably created some of the excesses of the dot-com space, but we've actually arguably created some of the price excesses, and I'm not talking credit excesses, of the pre-GFC housing bubble. Now, this is a lot harder to solve, Eric, right? As I said, you can tweet 5% on the NASDAQ, but how do you solve for this? How do you solve for affordability in housing? Well, one of the ways that you solve is that you see a collapse in activity. And back in the spring, we wrote to our clients and said, we actually wrote this piece, Housing One Step Back. We said, as rates rise, they are going to prick what is arguably a price bubble in US housing. And the end result is going to be a collapse in activity. And we showed them this particular model. And obviously, since the spring, it's become front page headlines in the United States. But this is definitively a big, big deal. This model has showing absolutely no signs whatsoever of basing at this point. And it is arguably below 06, 07 levels of activity. Now, I'm not saying that the credit excesses are there, okay? We don't have ninja loans and all those sort of things. But solving for housing affordability outside seeing a massive rise in rate in incomes or a huge drop in bond yields and hence mortgage rates is going to be very, very hard outside seeing a drop in house prices and a drop in housing activity, and both of those will have consequences. Now, the other area that we think is, and this brings us back to that treasury market, is we think a lot of the soft data has been highly exaggerated. So if you look at slide eight, you'll see ISM here against 10-year treasury yields. Now, we've been sitting around 60 in ISM, okay? That's an incredible number. I mean, that's an absolutely stonkingly incredible number. 60 is actually about as high as the thing ever gets. And historically, if you go back and look at periods where we've been printing 60, we've been printing 4% year-over-year GDP growth. Not the odd little quarter, sustained 4% GDP growth year-over-year. We aren't printing that. Today, we had revision to the growth numbers, and it was 3%. So how come ISM is at 60 and yet, which really should be commensurate with, let's say, 52, okay, on ISM, and we've been sitting at 60? How is that possible? Well, really, we think it's to do with the equity market. We think a lot of the reason why there's this fluff in some of this soft data is because when these executives fill out these surveys, they're really reflecting their confidence is partly to do with how well their stock options are doing. And they've been doing bloody well. And as this thing naturally starts to roll over, because it doesn't sit here, generally speaking, as you can see, it's a big broad sine wave. That would put, at least that you would say that it's tough in that environment to be short treasuries. Now, I have quite a lot of sympathy with that yellow box period. So if you look at 2004, 2005, well, typically we've seen treasury yields fall, okay? And I'm not dismissing that, but basically at this point, if you're making that bet, you're betting on a very, very weak equity market. And my suggestion would be, if you want to do that, just short the equity market rather than trying to buy the treasury market. But the point is it's not a great environment, I don't think, to be particularly short treasuries anymore. And actually, to our professional clients, we've recommended to get out. So ladies and gents, if we're saying now that it's tough to be short treasuries, okay, it raises the natural question, should you be buying treasuries? Now, I've still got some reservations about the broad market, and let me explain. So if you look on slide 10, let me show you the slide that you've seen before, which is this chart of 30-year treasuries going all the way back into the 80s. And what you can see here is that despite the weakness that we've been seeing in equities, 30-year treasuries have really not performed at all, right? We are still sitting well above that 100-month moving average, and we're even still sitting above the neckline of the inverse head and shoulders. So if you do want to buy, I certainly wouldn't be proposing to buy in the 30-year sector, not yet at least. Now, it could be a false break, but as I said, if you really want to bet on treasury, a lot lower treasury yields at this point, you're making a bet on the equity market. And my suggestion is you just go and make that bet on the equity market. Okay? You're really betting that that thing is going to drop hard. So go and buy some puts. Don't start doing a proxy in the treasury market. Certainly not at the long end. And another reason why I'm actually very nervous is slide 11. Now, I'm sure if you're on Twitter or, you know, you read some publications from brokers, you'll have seen, and this was back, you know, when yields were around 3% in 10 years, a lot of people sent around this chart saying, oh my God, look at the shorts in the futures market in the treasury pit. And they were extreme. What no one showed you was this chart. And this chart tracks positioning of treasury primary dealers. Okay? Now, these are the guys who get all sorts of benefits for standing up and, if necessary, taking down auctions and helping to support the treasury's issuance. And what I think you can see here pretty clearly is that since QT, those positions have risen to historic highs. So the holding or the inventory of those primary dealers is sitting at absolute highs. Here's the thing. In the old days, didn't used to cost a primary dealer, which is mostly a bank, any money to hold those treasuries on the books. Okay, zero risk weighting. They could be netted down to zero. Cost you nothing. Since the global financial crisis and all the reforms around Dodd-Frank and the Basel III legislation, it's become exceedingly expensive to hold treasuries on the books. And so I can assure you that primary dealers don't want to be holding this degree of inventory. This is involuntary inventory build. And as any one of you who studies economics will know, that's bad. Okay? And what seems to have happened is since QT, no one has shown up to replace the Fed's purchases. And what it's left is the primary dealers holding those positions. This is not a bullish sign for the long end of the market. Now, this makes it quite complicated. So we've got macro, which is arguing for you to potentially be long treasuries, but we've got structural and inventory issues and technical issues, which suggest that now is not a great time to be long. So the way that we've combined it, at least to our professional accounts, is we've suggested that they switch to curve steepeners. Now, this is basically where you look for an outperformance of the short end, in this case, 2 years versus 10 years. So you'd expect 2 year yields to outperform on the way down relative to 10 year yields. So that can happen in one of two ways. You can get what they call a bull steepener, where you get 2 year yields drop very, very sharply. Let's say the equity market implodes. Okay, that's what you'd expect to get, as those rate hikes that are priced into the front end of the curve just get priced out. Okay, that gets you a bull steepener. Or you can get a bear steepener. Well, let's say potentially that inflation breaks out and the Fed decides not to do anything about it. And the long end, together with this lack of demand, just gets eviscerated. Okay, now that's quite complicated, particularly the one at the top here, which is a forward steepener. But I just want you to potentially keep an eye on this. Okay, even if it's hard for you to trade, I would watch it. So this is 2 year swaps, 2s 10 swaps, 2 years forward. And really, it's a bit like playing 4 year or 5 year bonds. And the reason why it's interesting is this has already started to turn up. Okay. And if you look below at the cash curve, you'll see that generally, and we call it the curve's canary, generally this swaps curve starts to turn up first. And this is important because once that curve starts to turn up, you're already potentially moving into bear market in the equity market, a recessionary type economy. So this is definitively a bit of a warning sign. And this is how we at the moment have switched our stance in the treasury market.
Julian, before you move on, I see your next slide is labeled timing. Now, we're recording on Wednesday, the 28th, and just in the last couple of hours before we recorded this interview, the big news that everybody is freaking out over, and I stress freaking out, really is a fairly small piece of news. Jay Powell changed the word long way from neutral to just below neutral. That's the full extent of the actual news. The reaction to that news seems to be that the entire world has changed dramatically in an instant. Everything is completely different. Throw out the previous understanding. So my first question is the market overreacting just a wee bit here? And irrespective of that, I'm guessing that your timing slide was prepared before this news came out. Does that change any of what we're about to get into with respect to timing of these markets?
So the first thing, as I say, I think your interpretation is exactly right, Eric. I mean, it just would appear that we've just moved from night to day, and the clouds are lifting, and everything is glorious again. I do think, look, I spent years at Medley parsing the exact nuances of what central bankers said, and I think, to a certain extent, I think Powell is trying to achieve something that's very, very hard to do, and he's trying to control and steer a very unstable ship, which he inherited from courtesy of Janet Yellen's excessively easy policies. And so he's had to deal with it. You know, remember back in September, we had the comments that you just mentioned, you know, a long way from neutral. I think in part those are reaction to FOMC minutes, which the equity market took as incredibly dovish. And if you remember back then, but there were people saying, well, that's it, you know, deck, and then they're done. And, well, that means we can rally stocks back to new highs. And I think, in part, his what appeared to be very hawkish comment was an attempt to bat the market back to a more realistic stance. Because part of the problem is slowing the economy down entails not just hiking Fed funds. I mean, they don't just hike Fed funds in isolation. Right. They're trying to achieve a broad tightening of financial conditions within the broader economy. And that means affecting credit. That means affecting bond markets. That means affecting equity markets. And so if the equity market just runs all the way straight back, and this is part of the problem that we've had in this tightening cycle, that the equity and credit markets have utterly ignored what the Fed done. For the first time in modern history, we've actually seen the equity markets rally and credit tighten as the Fed has been hiking. And that's unprecedented. So it really leaves them in a very difficult situation. So I think in September, he was trying to be overly hawkish. I think this time he was trying to be a little dovish. I do think there have things that have quite dramatically changed in the last few weeks. I've just highlighted some of the excesses which appear to be unwinding, and they have to be very, very cognizant of that. But I do think it's interesting that you've got an equity market that is naturally, to some extent, has latched onto the most dovish interpretation of his language, because he said we are just below the broad estimates. So what does that mean? Well, I think firstly, it means 2.5 could be the bottom of those broad estimates. So maybe we're just going to go in deck, but that would be the most dovish interpretation of that, because the broad estimate, when I talk to friends of mine who are still in that policy space, they would put the broad estimate on the FOMC of where neutral Fed funds are is probably somewhere between sort of 2.5 and 3.5. So who's to say that we stop at 2.5? Maybe we go to 3.5. Maybe we just go to 3. I mean, I don't really think he's actually changed much, but I do think it sets us up timing-wise to actually a really interesting setup. And that is, if you look at the slide on slide 14, I've got a slide which I'm sure is going to upset a number of people, because this is a slide of Amazon. Now, as I've said in the past, I think we've discussed what we call a classic bubble on your show before, but a classic bubble is a chart pattern, okay? And it's really nothing to do with fundamentals, not interested in fundamentals. It is about psychology. It's about liquidity driving excesses. And ultimately, it's about greed and fear. Because in the mania period, what we've seen is excesses, right? Within a year, we doubled the market cap of Amazon. Right, the thing went from $1,000 a share to $2,000 a share, right? And we're not talking a small market cap. This is billions and billions of dollars. And that had to be fueled, I think, by a mania, because nothing materially changed. And so now we think we're busting. But the interesting part of any bust and the beginning of the bust phase is that the stock has to actually rebound. You have to have, just as you had, you know, back in Amazon's case in 2014 and 2015, a bear trap, you have to have a bull trap. And a bull trap can be a very, very rapid, rapid move up. And it can be a really extensive, in percentage terms, move up. So if this is a classic bubble, okay, you can have a move back all the way up to 1925, which is the neckline from which we broke down from. Percentage terms, huge. Okay, it's going to be greeted, I think, by the broad equity market exceedingly well. This, I think, is the sort of move that would get you back, maybe the S&P up to 2850. But if it fails there, this is one of the clearest signs, I think, of when you potentially, if you're looking to buy fixed income, as I said, I'm not looking to buy at the long end of the curve. For retail investors, I'd be looking at the shorter end, you know, 2 and 3 year, maybe out to 5 year. That's when you'd expect to see stuff like that. Maybe if you can trade euro dollars, you could start to look at sort of 2022 or 2021, so blues and golds. But this is a timing thing to me. If we get this, if what Powell's done, and if we get a positive outcome of trade over the weekend, okay, if what he has done is initiated that bull trap bounce, great timing opportunities. Now, one of the reasons why I'm a little reticent as well is about buying the long end, and timing, I think, is important, is our own work suggests that there's another bounce in inflation coming in Q1.
Julian, before you move on from slide 14, I just want to ask a question here, because as I look at this, I can't help but think, wait a minute, looks like what you're predicting, at least in Amazon, is if this is the classic bubble form, then we get this bounce in the summer of 2019 to a final high and a big move down from there. I wonder, is there a broader opportunity coming up to short the rest of the FANG stocks sometime in the spring or summer of 2019, and what would the things be to look at as we get into that time frame to confirm whether or not that still is the right trade to consider?
I think that's a very valid question, Eric, and the answer is yes. I think there are plenty of opportunities. I mean, we flagged to some of our clients. We got lucky. We caught Netflix almost at the highs within a few bucks. We caught NVIDIA. I put that one on Twitter. And we actually caught Amazon pretty well as well. They all have a very similar pattern, Eric. They've all been fueled, I think, by excessively easy policy. You can see on slide 14, I've highlighted when Amazon started to really outperform is when the ECB came in and launched QE together with negative interest rate policy. We discussed this back on your show, I think, earlier in the year, where we talked about what it did to term risk premium, how it crushed the risk or the rates associated with any sort of risk profile in the treasury market and essentially pushed US yields down to insanely low levels. And these stocks, all of them, rely on, so laughable at the sort of term growth stocks, they rely on churning through lots of incredibly, incredibly cheap capital, whether it's from equity holders or bond investors, to be able to generate that growth and that forward momentum, which investors are so interested in owning. And as that starts to turn around, or is turning around, certainly already in the United States, these things just it's a lot more difficult. I think Abelson in Barron's said, and I think perfect, you know, he's exceptionally good at this sort of thing. He summed it up as debt becomes less salubrious. Big problem for all of these stocks. So the answer is yes. I'd be watching all of these, and those three names in particular, Netflix, which I think is already really busted. It may not bounce all that much, but Nvidia and particularly Amazon, for a broader sign to get out of growth. Right? As I said, when you look at growth versus value, you have got back in September of this year, you were at March of 2000. And in other words, the high of the dot-com bubble extreme. So definitively, yes.
I've already made a note, Julian, to make sure that we get you back on the program toward spring, summer of 19 to make sure that we revisit this topic. And please continue. I think I interrupted you as you were moving on to inflation on slide 15.
No problem at all. So if you move on to slide 15, one other reticent thing that we're a little reticent about, and I think you've got to be careful in where and how you buy, if you want to buy treasuries. As I said, my inclination is to buy what the professionals refer to as the sort of belly of the curve. So sort of around 4 or 5 year sort of sector is inflation. Now, our own work suggests that there's another leg up in inflation coming. Now, it might be the last one, but I think it makes the job of the Fed quite hard. And on this slide, I'm just showing you actually their own metrics. So this in green here, you've got the New York Fed's underlying inflation gauge, UIG. And you can see that it perfectly caught and it dipped in the middle of this year. It leads and now is re-accelerating. And that's actually what we fear. We still fear that there's another leg higher in inflation. And if you look on slide 16, continued wage pressure. So if you're looking, even if you think some of the data is really turning and we are beginning to roll over, okay, I think you need to be quite careful about when and where you position. And as I said, my preference would be if you really think, oh, I've got to own treasuries because I'm bearish on the equity market and this thing is all going to roll over, then just go and bloody sell the equity market. And I think we have to remember that it's been a long time, but we have to remember that the Fed isn't always your friend, right? It's been a decade since 08 where the central banks have consistently had your back, right? And they've always been able to ease as risk assets wobbled, okay? Because they were worried about deflation. Now, if we move into a world where increasingly, and we think this is the case, going to be worried about inflation structurally, the Fed cannot be your friend. And maybe we can go back to a situation that we had in 2000 when with the NASDAQ down 35%, we get a burst of higher average hourly earnings and the Fed hikes 50 basis points, not just 25, 50. Now, I don't think the Fed's going to go 50, but the point is if you're sitting here and you're saying, well, I think the Fed's done, right? The equity market's down 5%, so they've got to be done. You're delusional, particularly if you think that the inflation and other data is going to continue as we do, at least into that first quarter, with wages and core inflation pushing higher. And it makes this treasury trade, I think, a lot more complicated now. Now, look, as I said, equity markets go straight down, fine. Bonds are going to rally. But even then, my preference would be to be focused on the front end of the curve and not to take that risk in the long end, because this something that stinks out there, and it's not good with the deficits that we are running and this lack of demand. It's a big problem.
Well, Julian, as always, I really enjoy your chart decks, and I'm particularly looking forward to getting you back on the air in the middle of next year because, as you say, it's very, very consistent with the view Patrick and I have had and have shared with our listeners. We think there's some kind of meaningful bounce coming in the equity market, but the highs are probably in, and it's not time to short yet. The question is when. So I really look forward to getting you back on the program to talk about that. Meanwhile, you're also going to be joining us in January in Vancouver for our Macro Voices live event. Give our listeners a little preview. What are you going to be talking to us about?
So, look, I'm really excited, not least for the skiing. No, obviously, I'm very excited to come and see everyone. It'd be fantastic, actually. What I really want to do in that presentation is to sort of talk about take some of these bigger picture views and really extend them out, because I think we're at a fundamental inflection point in markets. And if we are moving to a structurally and societally, I think we need it, phase of higher inflation, not necessarily with higher growth, I think the implications for how money has been run, particularly in the wealth management space, with these balanced portfolios and risk parity, are truly, truly profound. And I think that people miss sometimes the larger historical context of how do you transform, or how do you transfer from a period of low inflation to one of higher inflation, and what that can truly structurally mean for wealth. And these are some of the things that I'm going to try and do. I think pick out some of the areas where I think can perform within that period. And I really think, I hope it'll give people a great opportunity to think about how they manage their money. I think to really think about managing their money, because it's been very easy for the last 20 years since Alan Greenspan came out with the put to, as I said, always assume the central bank has your back, to always assume that bonds act as a hedge. And there's very, very few periods in history where that's even been close to the truth. So those are some of the issues that I think I want to try and touch upon in my speech.
Well, we're really looking forward to seeing you in Vancouver on January 19th. And of course, information about that event is at macrovoices.com/live. Meanwhile, Julian, I want to talk for a minute about Macro Insiders, the program that you and Raul Paul at Real Vision put together. And for anyone who's not familiar with it, it's not for everyone. It's kind of a high-end product, at least in the retail market. It's almost $4,000 a year for the regular subscription. You and Raul go into a lot of detail on various different macro topics, and you've got a lot of great content there. Real Vision ran a once-a-year Black Friday super-duper discount, 50% off, $1,950, and we wanted to be able to feature that. Unfortunately, the deadline, I believe, has already expired. We talked to our friends at Real Vision, and they were good enough to give Macro Voices listeners only a special extension on that deadline. So they've pushed it out a week, and there is a special link in the Research Roundup email just for Macro Voices listeners, allowing them to get that Black Friday price even well after Black Friday. Give people a quick understanding of what the Macro Insiders product is before we close.
So what we really, really wanted to do, Raul and I, is we wanted to try and help, let's say, informed or non-professional, I mean that wholesale professional traders and investors, the opportunity to really get a view from what we hope is some of the best macro research out there. Because I think that, you know, a lot of people understand how to trade equity and how to look at equity research, but they miss frequently the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is almost always set by macro, but getting hold of macro research is traditionally really difficult, Eric, as you can attest to. And I mean, I think your program is one of the few places where people can go. But what we try to do is to come up with some really investable themes, some truly structural themes, which we think people can profit from, and help them to do that. And, you know, Raul and I, in many respects, have quite similar views, but we also have quite divergent views at times. And that interplay between the two of us, certainly clients and subscribers have found, I think, very useful. So it really is designed to help you provide, even if you're just trading equities, right? Even if you're just trading equities, that overview that helps you manage through periods where macro is the driver, right? And we've just seen that in the last few months. Macro has become the driver again. We've seen years where central banks have suppressed macro volatility, and now it's back. And it's even more important, I think, at periods like that, in that transition phase, for people to understand how to use that to profit and make money. And that's what we try and help people do.
And again, there is a link in your Research Roundup email for the 50% off discount on that product, which is normally would have expired already, but they have extended it for Macro Voices listeners. On that note, we're going to need to leave it there, Julian, but I really look forward to seeing you in January in Vancouver. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Julian back onto the show. It's going to be great to see him out in Vancouver. I just wanted to comment, early in the interview, he references demographics and the importance of demographics in bond yields. And for me, I just don't know if I'm convinced that it's going to play out that way. As far as I'm concerned, you know, looking at the structural demand of bonds from the general public is not, in my mind, line up with the fact that we're in this late stage of this debt super cycle, and the fact that more and more intervention by central banks to manage the amount of debt in the system is going to be needed through all sorts of monetary intervention. I think that demographics is not going to play as big of a role. I don't know. What do you think of that statement?
Well, I definitely think that demographics plays a very important role. But as Julian said himself, you know, it's glacial pace background stuff. It's a major driving factor for the secular market. But you can have very significant, sometimes steep cyclical markets that go counter to the long-term trend. And I think that what really I took away from this interview was what Julian is really telling us is, you know, he's sticking to his guns that the secular bear market in bonds started with that one spot 34 or whatever the low print was that we had a couple of years ago. But it's about time for a counter trend cyclical bull market to take us in the other direction and embarrass as many people as possible, which is what markets love to do. So that finally starts to resonate for me because I was thinking about this view that we just go from here to much higher yields. And it's so hard, as much as I think that's coming someday, I really do see the long-term handwriting on the wall, to say that we go there now, as we're seeing right now so many signs of a possible oncoming recession, things that would normally be associated with lower yields. So the idea of a bull market in bonds that takes us back down to, let's say, 2% even, before we eventually resume a secular bear market that eventually takes us to those much higher yields, but maybe after the recession plays out, that makes a lot more sense to me. But particularly from an actionable trading standpoint, what I really took away from this interview was the steepener trade. And Julian's description was really brilliant, I thought. There are reasons this could go in either direction. And so you could see a dramatic performance at the short end, or you could see it at the long end, depending on whether recession forces or inflation forces are the driver. But one way or another, there's a good argument for that curve steepener. So I thought that was the actionable trade. And I guess finally, I'm really looking forward to meeting Julian, as you said. I've never met him face to face, and I'm looking forward to meeting him in Vancouver as well.
Eric, how's everything with your book coming along?
It's going great. Really appreciate the folks that have written reviews on Amazon. I've gotten quite a few emails as well, so I really very much am flattered by the fantastic feedback. If anybody is not aware of it, we did do a full interview about the book a couple of weeks ago, so I'm not going to repeat it there, but the information is at macrovoices.com. You'll see the cover of the book. You can click on it if you want to find out more information about the book. And for those of you who have read it or listened to the audiobook, I can't not tell you how much I would appreciate a review on Amazon. They are critically important to getting market traction behind a book. Amazon ratings are very much driven by user feedback. So if you enjoyed the book and have a moment to write a review on Amazon, I would tremendously appreciate it. But Patrick, I want to come back to the Big Picture Trading Chart Book. Folks, you can find that linked in your research roundup email. It says Big Picture Trading Chart Book. Let's go right into page 2 and talk about how this thing is playing out compared to the various scenarios that you have described in previous episodes of this program.
Absolutely. So actually charts two and three are work together. Chart two was simply a throwback to see what chart we showed everyone on November 8th, which is just we went through the scenario projecting out that as a roadmap, what would the markets look like if this was setting up to being like a 2016 diamond bottom, which is when the last major low occurred in the markets and everything turned super bullish. Then we were comparing it to the consolidation of after the 2018 VIX crash that's actually shown earlier on the chart. And then we also overlaid what it would look like if this was far more reminiscent of 2007-2008, just as the bear market was beginning. And what I wanted to on page three do is just give an update as to what actually has happened compared to those three scenarios. What we really had was a scenario that still, in my mind, looks a little bit more like 2007-2008 than the other scenarios. Now, we did double bottom, and back in February and April of 2018, we also had sort of a double bottom retest. So there's always a chance that this support line on the S&P holds. But really, what happens here, particularly around this 2750 level, will be rather telling. Because if we see an S&P, in my mind, that really starts getting some bullish price action north of 2750, that to me starts to put in a lot of the scenarios that we have a year-end little retracing rally, one that could theoretically have us go right back to November highs and or even higher on S&P. And that's the big but. If we fail here and the price action, this little Powell pop that we had here in the last 2 days, ends up not being able to hold, and somehow the G20 meetings spur a new round of selling, bringing it right back down, that would be rather disappointing. The price action would stay incredibly bearish under those scenarios.
Well, and you know, that makes me wonder, to my thinking, it's kind of a question of when the dovish reversal of Fed policy happens. Is it really happening now the way people seem to think it is? Let's pretend for the sake of this conversation that I'm right and it's not really happening quite yet and people are jumping the gun and that we find out that they're not ready to reverse policy and the market starts to go down. The thing is, that reversal is coming at some point. You know, the question is, what's the strike level on that Jay Powell put? And so, and when it does happen, what does it lead to? Because it feels to me like we're not ready to go straight down from here, that there's still some kind of bounce coming.
Well, look, you know what? The one thing that I've known, other than this move down in crude oil, that was just, if you were short, it's been didn't challenge you once on your position. But often with the stock markets, there's very violent snapbacks that occur that wash out those weak-handed shorts, the ones that took their positions too heavy or didn't hedge or simply don't have the staying power to stay short. The market always creates these massive whipsaws that guns for those traders. And the real question for, in my mind, over the next week, is this just that? Is this just simply the natural snapback, the dead cat bounces that happen? Or will, alternatively, the bulls actually grab this one and run with it? It'll be very interesting in the next week, that's for sure.
Well, I think definitely that what happens with the Fed is going to play a big role in that, because if I'm right and we find out that actually Jay Powell didn't mean what everybody wants to think he meant, then I think that creates your snapback, you know, your whipsaw back to the downside pretty darn quickly. In any case, let's move on to chart number four, which we borrowed from Julian Brigden.
Now, Eric, let me just cut you off there for a second, because the one thing I wanted to ask you is this. I mean, the Fed meeting is all the way, like, just a few days before Christmas. I mean, we still have many weeks from this. Do you think that there's going to be some signaling beforehand, or are we literally waiting 2-3 weeks for us to get a further signal from the Fed?
I think that if I'm correct and Jay Powell did not mean to signal what the market thinks it heard from him, I think the Fed will send some kind of signal to let them know, hey, we didn't mean it. If he did mean it, if that was exactly what he intended, then I think they stay silent until the meeting.
All right. So let's move on to chart four, which we borrowed off of Julian Brigden, because I really wanted to speak to it. He went through this idea. In this case, he was talking about the bubble stocks and they're overdue for a bounce. And he was using the chart of Amazon and kind of going with the idea that we're going to hit some sort of a short-term low, hit some sort of a dead cap bounce that could deeply retrace this first round of selling. And in the spirit of that, I mean, Julian did a good job explaining it, but in the spirit of that, I wanted to, on page five, really touch on what scenario the S&P could do that would be reflective of this idea that Julian has had. And so on page five, what I did was put on a chart that would show that, look, the S&P could potentially rally into December and even into the early part of January and retest the 2880 level, even on the upside of the S&P. That's a measured move that I was keeping an eye out for. With that being an upper target, what's interesting, and I think you'll speak to it here as well, is that Julian sort of in his chart is showing this idea that we first go lower on the market into early part of next year, and that this rally doesn't actually happen until the summer of next year. And the way I drew it on here is this kind of bounce happens right now. And what's interesting is that when you look at this chart, if we had a rally that approached anywhere near 2850 or 2880, to me, what one thing that it could start to look like would be one very big head and shoulders topping formation. And that we would simply be seeing a retest of the right shoulder to continue to solidify that the S&P is creating one big topping formation. But in that alternate scenario, you know, if we have a scenario very similar to 2007-2008, that would reflect far more like Julian Brigden's scenario, which is, let's say this market fails here at 2750. We get hammered again on the downside. Into January, we might see even 2500 on the downside of the S&P. And then from that level, we begin some very, very deep rally, retracing that very big sell-off. And that's where we get to 2800 going into like May and June of next year. That would be very 2007-2008. What's your feeling about that?
I think both of those scenarios are entirely possible, and I think it's very likely that Jay Powell telling us whether or not he really meant what people think he meant could be the determining factor. Because if it comes out that, yeah, he really did mean it, it is a dovish pivot in Fed policy right now, I think it does what you show on page five here, which is we keep moving up from here. We don't go to new all-time highs, because as much as, yeah, okay, it's bullish, if the Fed makes a dovish pivot, we don't have rate hikes as a headwind for the market, clearly that gives the market some room to recover to the upside. But why is the Fed making a dovish pivot? Because they see what we've been seeing, which is the economy is in real trouble. So eventually you get to that point where you form your right shoulder and the economy gets worse and we do head into recession. And now you've got your move down, as you're depicting here on page five. The other scenario is Powell didn't mean what they think he means. That takes us very abruptly, much sooner down to maybe a new lower low in the 2500 range or so. And maybe at that point, we get the Fed turning a little bit more dovish. And from there, we get the rally that lasts longer and takes us into spring, summertime of 2019 before we have the right shoulder. But I think that right shoulder is probably coming. The scenario where there is no right shoulder, it's just a rally to new all-time highs and everything is wonderful again, it's hard for me to see that. And of course, I've said it before and I've been proven wrong. But I really think that maybe this 10-year bull market, the longest in recorded history ever, is finally coming to an overdue end. And of course, exactly how that plays out, there's so many possibilities. The news flow is going to play into it. But I'll be surprised if we get to the end of 2019 and we're at new all-time highs. I think we're going to be more likely at new cyclic lows below where we've been so far by the end of 2019.
I couldn't agree more. So I wanted to touch on chart six now, moving on, where Art Berman sent us a really interesting chart, and I wanted to share it with our listeners, but it was really just showing the term structure of oil and going back at the chart structure on October 3rd and then progressively each week or so, how it's progressed every 2 weeks up until currently where the term structure was as of November 23rd. And what we're seeing here was we went from this very clear backwardation in oil to now pretty much trading almost in contango. And I really wanted to get your take on this. What's your feeling about how this played out, and what does it all mean?
Well, what you saw, first of all, and it is reflected to some extent in the pictures here, look at that October 3rd yellow line, and you move down a bit, but all those others between October 15, October 26, November 2, you've got really big moves down on the front month, but look at how the back months don't really move very much. But then just in the last week or so, from November 16 to November 23rd, the back end of the curve started to fall out. So the story that the term structure is telling you is, in the beginning, everything moved down because we were coming off of an artificial high. We moved down, and then the front month sold off dramatically, but it was just at the front of the curve. Why is just the front of the curve selling off? I think it was because what was happening was Saudi Arabia was producing more oil. The expectations going into the Iran sanctions don't play out the way everybody expected. Price sells off dramatically. Everybody says, it's got to be just short term. It's only going to affect the front end of the curve because this is a short term phenomenon. What we've seen in the last week is very telling, where you see the entire curve selling off. And that's a reflection of the market saying, Trump has really got Mohammed bin Salman between a rock and a hard place. He's got the ability to potentially disgrace bin Salman to the point of losing the throne. Maybe there's longer term possibility of Trump continuing to have that political pressure over Saudi Arabia, which prevents the Saudis from really pushing oil prices back higher. And without Saudi participation, there's no way that Russia's going to, do all the cutting on their own. If Saudi doesn't participate, then the whole market is going to move dramatically lower. And I think what you're seeing just in the last week is a perception of, maybe this political pressure that Trump has been playing against Mohammed bin Salman has some staying power to it. I think we're going to get the answer to that question in the next week. Either you're going to see the entire curve, including the back end, continue to drop like a rock, or you're going to see a rapid recovery led by the front end as everybody says, okay, it's over. That pressure that they had, Saudi Arabia is going to move forward and press for aggressive cuts, regardless of having been basically caught with their pants down over the Khashoggi murder.
Eric, I wanted to ask you one thing, though. What's your take on this? Do you think that we stay in a contango-style chart here for a short period of time, or are we going to go back to a backwardation here soon?
I think it entirely depends on what happens in terms of market perception about what I just described. If we move dramatically higher in front-end price, we're going to go back into backwardation. If we see the bottom fall out of the market, we'll go into steeper contango. And something that's really interesting to notice, as we sit here, $50, that seems like a big sell-off, but intuitively, you just think $50, that price is still almost double the low of $27 that we saw at the very low in the market in the beginning of 2016. But here's an interesting statistic. If you look at not the front of the curve, but let's just go out to 2020, the 2020 futures are less than $10 above their all-time low of $42 that was back in the beginning of 2016. So if you look at the longer-dated contracts, they're already within 10 bucks of their all-time lows. And if this market continues to move lower, there's a very real possibility that the back end of the curve makes new all-time contract lows below what happened in 2016, because those contracts never went below $50 for the most part in 2016, even when the front was very steep contango down at 26, 27. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. We're already too low on a fundamental level if Saudi Arabia still has all of its political bargaining power. The question out of G20 and OPEC is whether or not they do, or if Mr. Trump is going to manage to continue to assert the pressure that he seems to be asserting over Mohammed bin Salman. At least that's my read of it.
All right, Eric. Finally, I just wanted to share one last chart on page 7. And we're looking out here to those euro dollars, in particular that spread between the December 2018 and the December 2019 euro dollar futures contract, which in the LIBOR markets is a way of sort of gauging as to what the marketplace is pricing in regards to how many rate hikes in the 2019 year. And what's interesting is that according to this chart, at the start of October, we had the euro dollar markets pricing in nearly 60 basis points of rate hikes coming in next year. We saw in less than 2 months that nosedive from like 60 basis points to nearly 20 basis points. They've literally gone from like 2.5 rate hikes to they're not even sure if one rate hike is going to be fully in next year. And that's amazing to see there. Everyone is pulling forward their anticipation of the end of this cycle. And I just thought it was an amazing move. I don't think we've seen a move of this magnitude in a very long time. It's clearly, to me anyway, indicating that the market was far more optimistic about the markets, and the ground just shifted underneath the feet of traders as everyone's realizing that this whole thing is kind of unraveling faster than everyone expected. What's your take on that?
Well, it really speaks to Keith McCullough's call several weeks ago on the program. He sounded crazy, frankly, when he told us that he thought the Fed would cut in December for the last time, and that would be it. And at that point, if you looked at this chart, it looked like Keith is a wild man. At this point, it's priced in, or almost priced in. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out. I think that the big picture is we're headed toward this dovish pivot that everybody's expecting. I do think that it's coming. I thought it was not until 2019, maybe the middle of 2019, and maybe they would hike, you know, once or twice in the first half of the year, and then they would pause. If the pause is really starting now, it's definitely catching me off guard. But I suppose anything is possible. We'll see what happens. In any event, Patrick, we need to leave it there. I do want to touch on slide number 8 because you guys have been nailing it at Big Picture Trading lately. I know your members are doing very well. So if you haven't already, get a free 7-day trial to Patrick's service, Big Picture Trading. You can find the information at bigpicturetrading.com. Meanwhile, we need your help promoting Macro Voices. So please tell your friends and colleagues. Don't be afraid to donate this holiday season. Your donations go a huge way towards helping us to produce the program. Tell your friends and colleagues, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. Your benefit is that you'll get our free research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the best free content we could find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what they can find in this week's research roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the link to the chart book that Julian referenced throughout the interview. You'll also find the charts that Eric and I discussed in the post game. You'll also find a link to Jesse Felder's blog for where he wrote a really interesting piece that the Fed warns the drop in asset prices might be particularly large, as well as a great article from Kevin Muir, A History of First Rate Cuts. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.